Hello and welcome to the So What podcast, in which political economic analyst JP Lantman discusses the issues uppermost in the minds of South Africans. You can find a written version of this content on JP's website, jplantman.co.za. I am Ruda Lantman, and I am your host. This podcast, dated the 27th of January 2025, is titled AMSA, the Sound and Fury of a Partial Closure. We came back from a delightful holiday in Namibia and walked into a storm. What was it about? Was it just about steel factories closing?
Ostensibly, yes. It was about the announcement by ArcelorMittal South Africa, which we will refer to as AMSA, closing their long steel business. But in reality, Ruda, it's about much more. It's about import tariffs. It's about protection of local industry. It's about localization. It's about industrial policy. All these things came together in this AMSA issue. And it's what we do in this note in January. We unpack all these issues a bit.
Tell me about the origin and the history of AMSA, ArcelorMittal South Africa.
AMSA started its life as ISCOR, the South African Iron and Steel Corporation, which was founded by Hendrik van der Bijl, the man who single-handedly industrialized South Africa way back in the 1920s. It became a big steel business in South Africa, and it played a huge role in producing the steel and many steel products that you need in a modern economy. What I think is important to remember is that the old ISCOR consisted of two businesses, steelmaking, but they also had a mining side. And on the mining side, they had iron ore and coal mines. And the benefit of having iron ore mines is that you can buy or acquire the iron ore that you need for steelmaking cheaply. If you have your own mines, you can make arrangements. And that's the way in which the old ISCOR operated.
And then how did it become ArcelorMittal?
Yes, in 1989, ISCOR was privatized and listed on the Joburg Stock Exchange. In 2001, 12 years later, it was split into two separate companies. The one is ISCOR Steelmaking and the other one Kumba Resources. And they took the iron ore and coal mines. In 2004, Lakshya Mittal, that we will talk about, bought the company and he changed the name from ISCOR to Mittal Steel. And in 2006, I think the problem started because then Kumba Resources itself was split into two companies, Kumba Iron Ore, which still exists today and is a very profitable miner of iron ore, and Exxaro. And Exxaro Resources, as you know, is a company, coal company, mining and coal company, also listed on the JSE. So that's the history. Now, this split up of Kumba between coal and iron ore had the effect that in 2010, Kumba Iron Ore cancelled the arrangement that they had with the old ISCOR, or Mittal Steel, to provide iron ore for the steelmaking on preferential terms. They wanted a much more market-related agreement. There were court cases and negotiations and political interventions and so on. But in 2013, Kumba Iron Ore and Mittal Steel made an agreement where they still bought the iron ore from Kumba, but at much less preferential terms. And that must have hit AMSA's or ISCOR's balance sheet considerably.
Another thing that comes up in this whole conversation is the difference between long steel and flat steel. Explain that?
Yes. As the names indicate, long steel is anything that is long. bars that you use in reinforced concrete, for example, railway tracks, it's long steel. Anything like that goes through as long steel. Flat steel is basically sheets which are made, whether you use it, the sheet to fold it and use it for car manufacturing, or whether you use the sheet to fold it into corrugated iron that you can put on a roof. It's basically long versus flat. Now, what AMSA is doing, they're closing their long steel business, but it's important to note that they're not closing their flat steel business. That will continue.
What part of the business is the long steel?
They don't disclose the numbers, but the general understanding in the market is that long steel is more than 50% of AMSA's business. So it is a big part of the company.
What is the global context? What's happening in other places across the world?
Well, what happened in the first half of the 20th century is that many, many countries in the world had the belief that just as you had to have a national airline to be a serious country, you had to have steelworks and you had to have your own steel company. And therefore, a lot of governments in the world created steel companies, like the government here created Iskor in the 1920s, exactly the same story. Now, the problem is if everybody is building a steel factory, then there's huge overcapacity in the world. Many of these steel companies, particularly the government-owned ones, ran into financial difficulties. And there's an Indian entrepreneur, Mr. Mittal, who saw the opportunity. He started buying up these steel companies worldwide. And of course, he rationalized them, reduced the staff numbers, sweated the assets, and he himself became fabulously wealthy. And in the process, he drove the consolidation of steel capacity worldwide. And this process has been ongoing. And Mr. Mittal's rationalization drive was not the only one. For example, British Steel, which for a long, long time was the biggest steel company in the world, had massive rationalizations and buying up other companies and merging and so on. And in the end, they themselves merged with the Dutch steel company Koninklijke Hoogwoffens and became Corus Steel. Corus Steel, in turn, was taken over by another Indian company, Tata. And what Tata did was to close down a huge amount of capacity. And today the UK, which once had British Steel and was a very, very big steel producer, today the UK produces about 25% of what they produced in the previous century. So a lot of capacity has been closed down worldwide. And this Lakshya Mittal initiative and the Corus Tata initiative is not the last. We've seen very recently Japan Steel, Nippon, wanted to buy U.S. Steel, and it's a transaction that was vetoed by President Biden when he was still in office. And it all plays into this thing of overcapacity in the world, trying to protect jobs, trying to protect old industries, and it's an ongoing process.
Was the closure of the, at least the long steel part of ArcelorMittal, unexpected?
Not for people who were in the industry. We have a friend who used to be in steel construction his entire life, a civil engineer. After he retired from steel construction projects, he became a professor at the engineering faculty at Stellenbosch University. And about 8 years ago, a long time ago, he guided one of his master students to do a thesis on can you develop long steel products, particularly steel bars, from welded steel. In other words, can you use flat steel products to produce a product which is normally made in long steel? And this was 8 years ago. And I asked him, so what prompted you to guide the student? And he said, look, it was already clear 10 years ago that long steel is in trouble because there's this huge overcapacity worldwide. If you can import long steel from Indonesia, I'm just mentioning a name, or you can import it from India, why on earth would you make it in Vereeniging? And he saw this coming. So for people in the industry, it wasn't quite a surprise.
Then there's a whole raft of other players in the field called mini mills. What are they and what do they do?
Steel is made from iron ore in a furnace, and you get your products out on the other side, long steel or flat steel. But what you can also do is you can use scrap metal. And you can use electricity at very high temperatures to melt it. So you put the scrap metal in on one side, and the other side you've got steel products coming out.
Recycling,
basically. Now, we haven't had mini mills in South Africa. It's a phenomenon of the last 10, 17 years, to be precise. And how it works is like this. If you're a scrap metal merchant, and you buy scrap metal from wherever in a public officer to you, you're not allowed to sell that or to export it. You first have to offer it to a mini mill in South Africa. And the price that you have to offer it at is the international price of scrap in Rotterdam minus 30%. So in that way, the scrap dealers, of course, take a cut. They suffer a little bit. They can't now export at market prices. But the mini mills get it at Rotterdam minus 30%. So their input cost is much lower. And therefore, a whole flourishing mini mill industry started to develop in South Africa. As I said, 17 years ago, there was nothing. And today, this policy of benefiting or helping mini mills has resulted in 50% more or less of long steel products in this country being made by mini mills. In the past, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, AMSA made the whole lot. Now their market share is down to probably less than 50% because there's also still imports. So the rise of the mini mills on the back of an aggressive government policy has also changed the landscape quite considerably. Now, these two elements of the mini mill policy, i.e. scrap metal must be offered at 30% discount and you cannot export it, the export ban and the price regulation go together. The question is, if you take those two things away, will the mini mill industry survive? And we just don't know. The current arrangement is scheduled to end in 2027. I think it's June 2027. But of course, it can be renewed. Now, ArcelorMittal and many other players in the country are pushing very strongly that this it shouldn't be renewed, that in 2027, the subsidy effectively for the mini mill should fall away. We will see what happens in 2 years' time, and we'll have to see how many of the mini mills can survive. But I must just make one point quite clear. A lot of people think that mini mills are just it's just a sort of an inferior operation. And that's not the case at all. Score Metals, which in fact is more or less the same age as ArcelorMittal or Iscor, formed more or less at the same time, they are also now a big mini mill producer, and they export high-quality steel products all over the world, including to China. Now, there can't be too many companies that export steel products to China. So it shows you it is possible to be a mini mill and run a highly sophisticated operation. That is quite possible.
Does ArcelorMittal itself play in this field?
No, not at all. They never invested in the technology. Mini mill operate on an entirely different machinery, entirely different technology, and no, they never invested money. And in fact, if you go through all the reports and so on, there's a lot of criticism of AMSA that they made the wrong capital allocation decisions over the years. People say they could have spent their money better and they would be a much more productive and a better steel producer today. Now, I'm not wading into that argument. I'm just noting that those accusations are there, that they haven't spent their money in the most optimal way.
What does the steel market in South Africa look like? How much do we use? What do we produce here? Do we import?
Yeah, that's very interesting. We've got capacity between ArcelorMittal and all the mini mills to produce 8.8 million tons of steel a year. Last year, we only produced 4.1 million tons, less than half. And of those 4.1 million tons, we imported 32%, or about 1.3 million tons. So that gives you the story. Now, the steel people, AMSA in particular, argues that if the economy is growing at a higher rate, then there will be more demand for steel and things will be better. Well, that's of course true, because steel demand is very sensitive to economic growth. 3% is much, much better than 1%. And as you know, we've been growing at 1%. That will change once you've got 3%. But does that mean that our full capacity will be utilized? Not necessarily, because as I've said, even under these depressed conditions, we import 32% of our steel. So if there's a bigger demand for more steel, you may find that your imports also go up.
Why do we import if we have the local capacity?
It's all about price and quality. So, you know, steel is not just steel, and steel products are not made the same. I'll give you two examples. In previous times, in the old South Africa, when we still built railway lines, we imported 30,000 to 40,000 tons of railway tracks a year because the old Iscor then couldn't produce them locally. Today, we've got a very flourishing motor car industry. We import about 300,000 tons a year for steel that go into the assembly of motor cars. So either the prices locally cannot compete with foreigners or the quality is not there. So that's why you have imports. And that will probably carry on even if there's a higher demand for steel.
Could tariffs make a difference, with President Trump at the moment seeming to think that tariffs are the answer, whatever the question?
Look, at the moment there is an import tariff on imported steel of about 9%. AMSA says it's not enough, they want 25%. And that really takes you to the heart of the matter. Do you force consumers to pay more for a product in order to protect the local industry, or do you subject the local industry to competition? And there's no clear answer on it. There's no right or wrong. It's a public policy choice that you make. AMSA likes to point out that there are countries like Mexico, for example, where there's 82% import tariff on steel. We've seen that President Joe Biden refused to take over by Nippon of U.S. steel. So it plays into jobs, into politics, into protection, localization, that sort of story. In the end, I don't think tariffs will make much of a difference. That's the experience worldwide. In the end, you have to have the best product at the best price. And to get to the best product at the best price, you need investment. You need the latest technology. You need the latest machinery. You need best practice. If you don't apply that, then you're not going to make it, irrespective of what the
You need scale.
And you need scale. That's a very important point. You need scale. And if your local economy is not big enough, well, then you must be good enough to export. And that brings you back to best practice, best product, and so on. Yeah, so scale is absolutely important. If we look at the world today, in many industries, take, for example, electric cars, the Chinese are just way, way ahead. What do they have? They have the latest technology, better than anybody else, including Tesla, and they have scale. And that enables them to produce cars to the extent that build your dreams. The EV manufacturer in China has begun to outsell Tesla. That's what happens when you've got the technology and you've got the skills and you've got the scale.
We also see it here in the poultry industry.
Absolutely. Steel and chicken bring to the fore the same issues. We pay an import levy on imported chicken. Chicken is the country's biggest source of protein. So now your consumers pay more for their protein than what they would have if there were no tariffs. On the other hand, you're protecting the local industry. And there's your choice. What do you want? Consumers pay more or subsidize a local industry? And again, there's no right or wrong. Make your choice. It's a public policy choice that you have to make.
Shifting our focus back to steel, what's going to happen? What are the possible scenarios?
Well, the interesting thing is, for the short term, it's important to note that at the end of November last year, SARS, the Revenue Service, imposed import tariffs on what is called structural steel products from China and Thailand. In the case of China, the levies are 52%. In the case of Thailand, 9%. So those are clearly two countries which are export products to us very competitively. That's why they put it in. But that's a temporary measure for 6 months only, while ITAC is the International Trade Commission, investigate allegations of dumping, and they will make recommendations. And then we will see which way it goes. So that's the one thing. The other thing to bear in mind, Rida, that's happening, the Chinese have built an ultra-modern steel plant in Zimbabwe. And they came into operation last year, and those products have already started arriving in South Africa. So we can see steel imports from Zim taking place here. A third development that's taking place, different Chinese companies are looking at building a steel factory in Limpopo. But there's huge, huge environmental resistance to it. So something that I was just wondering about is, what are the possibilities that those steel companies are convinced, instead of building in Limpopo, rather take over the plants that AMSA is closing? Refurbish them, make them modern, put in new equipment, and run with that existing infrastructure in terms of roads, railways, water, and so on, rather than stuffing up the Limpopo province. But I don't know what will happen. We'll have to see how these things play out.
Is that just a twinkle in your eye, or do you know that something is happening?
No, it's just a twinkle in my eye. I know that the Chinese are trying to build a steel factory in Limpopo, and I know there's huge opposition. We'll have to see how that plays out.
But it sounds, as you've said, that this is fundamentally about industrial policy and not just South Africa. It's a point of principle everywhere.
Yes, it is. Now, there's a very interesting Japanese economist, Richard Koo, K-O-O, who wrote some very interesting books on what he called persecuted economies. And what is a persecuted economy? It's an economy that had a golden era of manufacturing and industrialization. And then the golden era passed. because new economies came up that were more efficient, more better technology, later equipment, and so on and so forth. And they started persecuting the old economy. So the old economies, in the way he tells it, is the US, the UK, Europe, even to some extent Japan. Who are the new economies? Taiwan, South Korea, China, and as we've seen, Thailand. So they become to eat away. The hunters of yesterday have become the hunted of today, and the new hunters persecuting the old hunters. This is a fundamental development that's taking place worldwide, and it's happening in a large number of industries. For example, the German car industry, I think, is in huge trouble as a result of competition from Chinese car companies who've built an enormous car sector. So the question is, how do you position yourself in the light of that? And my own feeling is that it's no good trying to maintain that which comes from yesterday. Yesterday's industries cannot be sustained. There could be a transition period. There could be a time that you allow for adjustment. But in the end, you cannot protect the old industries. You've got to develop new industries through innovation, new discoveries, and so on. And that's where I think we have to focus. The persecuted economies had their golden era. It's over. They must now look at chips or satellites or, you know, what other industries there are in which they can excel. They can't excel any longer in the old industries.
So coming to so what, how serious is this in the picture? The closing down of the ArcelorMittal long steel business?
Not as serious as the media furore suggested. First of all, Kobus Verster, the chief executive of AMSA, he himself has said that once they've closed down the long steel business, they can actually have a very flourishing flat steel business. So that's there. We know that on the long steel side, 50% of the product currently in the country is being supplied by minimal. So it's there. Thirdly, we know that there are strong imports and that we can import more from whatever we need from overseas countries. So I don't buy the narrative at all that the entire steel industry will now collapse, and with that, the further argument that manufacturing will collapse. I mean, for example, the automobile components industry. They're lamenting and shouting and screaming and so on, but they also said the closure of Newcastle, if it can be postponed for 12 months, then minimals can be certified by the auto manufacturers for having the quality and the standard needed for the motor car industry. So that's a period of transition. You upgrade yourself if you're a minimal, put in whatever the automakers want, and life carries on. Now, I think it's part and parcel of life where old industries die out and you adjust to new ones. Think of gold mining. There was a time when South Africa was the biggest gold producer in the world. Today, we don't really feature. Why? Well, because all the gold has been taken out. Industries rise, industries die. The question is, how do you adapt?
And for you, you don't normally really put forward your opinion, but you do this time. What is for you the so what when it comes to public policy?
No, I think we should focus on those. We should have an industrial policy. That's number one. Not one based on subsidies and protection, but one based on developing new industries where we've got a competitive advantage. Now, I mentioned here, for example, green energy. We are abundantly blessed with solar and wind resources. We can use that to build a green energy industry. We can build hydrogen, for example. Tourism. We are abundantly blessed with tourism assets. With that comes conservation. So those are areas where we've got a competitive advantage. Then there are areas where the capabilities of the nation enable us to compete. For example, hospitality and personal services. Think of hospitals. People will tell you that the treatment they get in hospitals here are better than what they get in many European countries. So focus on that. Enable that kind of industry to grow and to expand and employ more people. Then there's arts and culture. I don't have to tell you about the success of something like Jerusalema and other South African artists. So instead of thinking just in terms of smokestack factories, think of these new industries that we have, which we can expand. And lastly, take agriculture. You know, we've got a highly, highly successful agricultural industry. So if you're successful in agriculture, think of what is just next to it, agro-processing. What can we agro-process where we have a competitive advantage that we can compete in the world? So that, I think, is the approach one must take, is not to defend the old, but to develop the new, and from there, get economic development.
Thank you for listening to the So What podcast. If you enjoy this content, please don't forget to leave a review and a rating, and please consider subscribing so you don't miss any future episodes. Also, tell your friends. Remember, you can find a written version of all JP's content at jplandman.co.za.